You know, you just about can't pick up a magazine these days or open your own mail without seeing someone offering you to help take your practice to the next level of productivity. It's almost starting to sound like ads for weight loss. You know, there never seems to be a shortage of people looking to lose weight or companies trying to help them do just that. You know, I saw a CNN survey recently that indicated that almost 80% of the population that's over 40 years of age is trying to lose weight all the time. I wouldn't be surprised if this same statistic held true for doctors seeking to attain the next level of practice productivity. So why is practice growth such a challenge? Hey, why is weight loss such a challenge? Anyone who's ever succeeded at taking off a few pounds will tell you that in the end, it all came down to eating less of the foods that they once thought they could not live without. Even though there are numerous weight loss programs, wafers, pills, diet shakes, it finally comes down to taking that simple risk of finding out what happens when you let just one evening go by without eating the pint of Ben and Jerry's Rocky Road or Chunky Monkey. The first time you do this, it's almost comical. You honestly believe that your throat's going to close up or that your lungs are going to fail if you don't toss back some sweet delicacy that you've convinced yourself earlier in the day that you would resist. But now that you're actually facing the temptation, you don't resist. You know, today was rough, and besides, I deserve it. Oh yeah, I ate the baked potato chips instead of the fried potato chips for lunch. Doesn't that offset the two brownies that I'm about to put away with a scoop of ice cream on top? You know what I'm talking about. It isn't that you don't know you should lose weight, or that you don't know that eating everything you see will cause you to gain weight. It's that there's a part of you that stays hidden all day, making you feel confident that maybe you really can stay on your diet today. Maybe today will be different. But then the urge comes to indulge, you know, seemingly from nowhere. It seems to have the power to block out the logical part of your brain that previously argued for a shot at just one night without eating a handful of chocolate chip cookies. When I work with doctors on the challenges of breaking practice growth barriers, I feel like a weight loss coach, if there was such a job. I find that most doctors really know how to fix most practice growth blockages. What they don't know or accept is that they have a problem in the first place. You might find that funny or inaccurate, but I don't. I find it dead spot on. What I want to cover on this recording is really the heart of the next level barrier that most of our doctors face. Now, I acknowledge that there are as many individual behavioral barriers as there are doctors, and I want to address those at some other time on a different recording. Today, I want to explore the three most common growth barriers that we as practice coaches spend most of our time addressing. They are as follows. Number one, capacity denial. Number two, default faithlessness. And number three, practicism denial. Now, I realize that you've heard me mention several of these in times past, but I still find that most of our Whitehall-ized doctors still suffer from them. Just like people who read a new diet book every week and then continue to gain weight, let's start with capacity denial. This simply means that your practice has a capacity barrier and you either don't know it or you're not acknowledging it even though you do know it. Since I realize that it's a stretch to ask you at this point to take all of this on faith, let me illustrate. I talk to a doctor and she tells me that she can see more patients and that it's the staff that are the problem. They're dragging her down. I talk to the staff and find that every time they exceed a certain number of patients in a day, the practice quickly falls back to its comfort zone. They tell me that the doctor is predictably overwhelmed during certain times of the day and that patients waiting to be seen will often walk out angry after having been left waiting long past their appointed visit. I'll ask the staff to give me names of the patients and the days of these encounters. When I make this presentation to the doctor with the names and the dates, the doctor tells me that it was a fluke and that if everyone had just planned ahead and done their job, there wouldn't have been a problem. We find that the doctor will naturally see their existing capacity idealized. Staff, on the other hand, see it as it really is. They will see that there's a natural chaos factor that comes out of trying to get a schedule full of patients to be on time and smoothly flow through the practice. Because of this idealized perspective, the doctor is seldom ready to take on what I call high-risk capacity projects. High-risk projects are the ones that involve spending $900,000 for a major expansion or hiring a second doctor or an additional assistant when one isn't already in full demand? That means you want to see patients backed up around the block before you unbank the bling and buy some additional productive capacity. Actually, it's not that difficult to convince doctors that they're capacity blocked when they know unconsciously that all they have to do is speed up their treatment time or turn an existing idle space into a treatment area. The doctors who get it quick are the ones that don't have much to risk by acknowledging the blockage. The ones that face betting the farm on a new clinic are the ones that always think there must be another way to wring out a little more production from this existing space or from these personnel. This helps explain why you have to have an accountability system with a coach or with an incentivized team, you answering to their bonus, if you're going to ever move ahead. Unless someone is telling you that you've run out of options and that expansion is essential, you're likely to slip back into that denial state that always says there must be a way to do more with what we already have. I just haven't figured it out. After all, I'm not sure I would be profitable if I did move. Yeah, I know that. Don't use the profitability defense to justify what I call supervised stagnation. I realize that this is really a topic for another monthly recording, but let me just address that excuse if I could for a second. The reason I call it as an excuse is that I've learned that overhead is not really a factor of your monthly expenses or your spending. It's a factor of how you practice. A doctor with poor profitability, that is a poor profitability profile, will suffer at any level of monthly cash flow. For example, if he underdevelops his cases, or if she underprices her services, or if the team is unmotivated, therefore requiring two additional, therefore unnecessary team members to get the job done, if case acceptance is low, or if you have to buy patients through expensive advertising campaigns because your receptionist is offending callers, you're going to have a high overhead regardless of where you practice or how cheap your existing space is. If your practice has the classic capacity blockage profile, that is, your numbers consistently rise and fall each month, you need to accept the possibility that you need to think the unthinkable. You know what I'm talking about, hiring another staff person, moving to a larger space, taking on $800,000 or $900,000 of debt. I'm going to be the first to admit that capacity blockages are subtle. I recently read about the amazing natural ability that certain insects have to move to the unobservable side of an object that you're about to pick up. It's almost like a cartoon skit where Bugs Bunny moves to the opposite side of the telephone pole, no matter how quickly his opponent scans all sides of the pole looking for bugs. The article said that this explains how people are so often stung by scorpions and black widows from picking up a board or a rock. The victim thinks they've fully examined the rock for desert dwellers, only to find themselves with a numb, throbbing hand and no observable explanation for it. Practice capacity blockages carefully hide themselves behind our desire to make more money without taking more financial risk. Capacity blockages stifle growth by frustrating patients and traumatizing staff. A patient, new or otherwise, who finds they can't get on the schedule at a convenient time will usually not become angry. Hey, they don't want to see you in the first place anyway. They'll drift into a fog for several months until their problem becomes so pronounced that they quietly acknowledge to themselves that if they're going to get treated, they're going to have to see a new doctor for now. See, it's amazing, isn't it? Even our patients use denial. They actually mean to come back in to see us when our schedule isn't full. The problem is that they soon bond emotionally with the new practice doctor and staff, and we've lost them for good. Notice that they never got upset enough to really hammer us. This is why capacity blockages remain forever hidden in your average practice. It's like a couple in a troubled marriage that get a separation in an effort to somehow save their marriage. In truth, they're drifting apart. Chances of reconciliation are little more than the dreams that arise from the denial plant that works overtime in the average unrealistic brain. A practice that only frustrates patients will see old patients filing off in exact proportion to the number of new patients filing into the practice. Now, a practice that offends patients will lose more than it can add to the rolls of the practice under normal circumstances. I've also noticed that doctors who feel that they've searched for the capacity blockages and not found them will naturally conclude that they must not be there. When you can show me a consistent set of openings for both new patients and regular patients of record during the high demand times of the day, I'd listen to your argument about not having a capacity blockage. You see, there's another type of blockage that's so insidious that most doctors would probably be happier not knowing it even exists. I'm talking about front desk screening. Granted, it's usually done because the staff person believes that their doctor is already seriously overwhelmed. When a front desk staff person feels that a practice is overwhelmed during its peak demand times, she will naturally slow down the flow by tightening the intake screen of the practice. Now, if you think about that, it's a smart move. If we're already too busy, why not just let the callers who are perceived by the staff as being easier to work with or more valuable to the practice be the ones that get these few appointments during the peak demand times? As I said, this can also be an insidious problem. I'm not just referring to the survival reaction of the staff person I just described, who was trying to limit the flow so that patients didn't get angry. I'm talking about the insidious attitude screen. An attitude screen can be almost imperceptible, almost impossible to identify directly, because it's, in many cases, nonverbal communication. I believe that you could sit next to a staff person who doesn't want the practice to be busy and still not be able to see how she blocks the practice. The only way this usually gets spotted is that the consultant isolates the problem, eliminating all other variables so it couldn't be anything other than how she answers the phone, or the offending employee goes on vacation and new patient numbers jump by 200%. I received a phone call 1 week ago today from a client who told me that he had identified a previously undiscovered screen at his front desk. Listen to this. You know, he's an amazing guy, an amazing practice promoter. He told me that after removing the front desk screen that he didn't know was there, his monthly new patients increased by 150 additional new patients per month. I know, that sounds like an unbelievable number, but you have to know this guy to believe it. And I know him, and I believe him. He's already getting just over 200 new patients a month before he discovered this undiscovered screen. You see what I mean? You'd probably be happier not knowing your front desk is keeping 150 new patients a month out of your practice. If what I'm saying is true, that is that a staff person's attitude alone can keep substantial numbers of great new patients out of your practice, you'd better learn to watch the monthly numbers for signs of just such a blockage. As I already mentioned, when the numbers go up and down and up and down as if they were hitting an invisible ceiling, you can know that the blockage is there. Just because you haven't identified it doesn't mean it's not there. So you need to at least acknowledge it and say, even though I can't find this, I know it's there. Then go to work to find it. And don't stop until you do. And don't stop until you've fixed it. All right, let's go on to the next barrier, what I call default faithlessness. This term refers to a doctor's natural tendency to suffer from disbelief. Some of you have heard me say this at seminars. It's not what you don't know that holds you back. It's what you don't believe. You see, you can know something and still not really believe it. You can know, for example, that you don't live forever. In fact, you say this every day of your life. Hey, you don't live forever. You usually say this right before you go off your diet or buy something you can't afford. But when the time comes that you're facing the certainty of your own death, I promise you, it will come as a surprise. We all know this, but it's not real. We don't really believe it. People knew the stock market was overpriced a few years ago. They knew that tech stocks priced at 5,000 times earnings had to eventually come back to earth. But when it happened, when the market collapsed, people were in a state of shock. Doctors would call on the phone. Their staff would call and say, Greg, can you talk to our doctor? He's really upset about his finances. And they would give him the phone, and I could just hear him making this sound at the other end on the receiver. I pictured the receiver laying on a desk next to a fish who was taken out of the water and his mouth was going back and forth. I could just see the doctor going, Greg. And he would say, I lost all my money. I can't believe it. I said, well, did you know that, you know, tech stocks priced at 10,000 times earning were overpriced? He goes, yes, I knew it, but I didn't believe it would ever end. Or I believed I would get some warning. Somehow I would know that it was time to get out and I would be spared while all around me people were being destroyed financially. See, people knew the market was overpriced, but they didn't believe it. When you know something is possible, as opposed to really believing it's going to happen, you're not emboldened to take the necessary risks to have a production breakthrough. For example, you can know that it's entirely possible to increase your practice production right where you are and with the team you have. But if you don't really believe it, you won't make the high-risk changes that it takes to bring about growth. Now, notice I said where you are with the team you have. So in other words, you're not going to be hiring people or moving to a new space and taking on $1 million of debt. So where's the high risk? Well, I'll tell you. When you have to behave outside your normal personality style, it seems like high risk. If you're non-assertive, to become assertive. If you're assertive, to back off. To relate to patients in a different way. To connect with them by opening up when you're not the kind of person that likes to open up. All of these are high-risk changes, and you're just not going to do what's comfortable unless you believe it. We get this complaint all the time from staff that the doctor came home from maybe a seminar or he listened to some tapes, and he changed for a week or two, but then he's drifted back into what he was comfortable doing. So he didn't change long enough to actually see the benefits or get the payoff. These are high-risk changes. We're not talking about taking on $1 million of debt, but when you behave outside what makes you comfortable, that's a high-risk change. Now, if you've got your staff to become accountable to, they'll help you stay in that posture, that high-risk posture, long enough to get the payoff and see that, yes, this works. Patients don't get mad at you if you push a little harder or you don't push as hard. And, you know, they will still be good patients. So here's the real underlying problem that lack of belief presents. See, maybe you've had one breakthrough. That is, you've managed to miraculously see and acknowledge your capacity blockages. The problem here is that as surely as you'll have difficulty spotting a capacity blockage, you'll lack the basic belief it takes to risk major changes to yourself or the practice. With faithlessness, you don't believe that the needed capacity changes will actually be as effective in your practice as they are in other practices, or as you've heard them being successful in other practices. That's right. Doctors have usually spent years convincing themselves that their practice, their team, the town, is somehow unusual. Things that work elsewhere don't work here. When they fail to solve the capacity puzzles, marketing mysteries, or staff challenges, it's emotionally easier to simply blame the area or the type of people that are naturally attracted to a town like this. I think you're starting to get the picture. Practice growth is a prize reserved for the doctors who can overcome these two very powerful urges. Number one, to naturally fail to see that you've run out of productive capacity so as to prevent you from having to consider some of the high-risk solutions that we discussed. And two, to naturally fail to believe that normal practice building and patient-pleasing techniques that work elsewhere will actually work in your town, in your practice, with your staff and patients. This is one of the main goals of the team training camp, to use the seeing is believing technique to break through the default disbelief barrier. It's common to have doctors come up after the hot seat portion of the seminar and say that they feel foolish because someone they've seen up on the hot seats who has less ability and a weaker team, less square footage, is actually outproducing them by half. These doctors are often transformed at the very molecular level just by seeing the hot seats.